A very warm and loving Sairam to all our listeners all around the globe. It is one beautiful afternoon in Prashanthi Nilayam. You know, winter afternoons are always beautiful at Prashanthi Nilayam because summers get very hot and winter seems to have that perfect blend of warmth and coolness, a coolness that we can enjoy and a warmth that we can cherish. So it is one such beautiful afternoon in Prashanthi Nilayam, and it is with great joy, enthusiasm and energy that myself, Arvind from Team Radio Sai, and along with me, Brother Prem from Team Radio Sai, we are sitting here in the beautiful studios of Radio Sai, ready for another segment of Afternoon Satsang. I would like to offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of Bhagwan, who is here sitting and listening to every word as we speak, inspiring thoughts, inspiring feelings, and making us speak words. And we would like to thank all our listeners who have tuned in with us, and we hope this will be an enjoyable presentation. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind. And indeed, a difficult topic we've chosen today, and we definitely need Swami's blessings to get through this one.
Yeah, sealing on desires is something that is a sort of a cliche in the Sai world, you know. Almost everyone has heard it in some context or the other. But an actual study into the sealing on desires shows us that it is something so much deep, so much more profound, and more than anything else, it is actually the way nature is designed, the way humans, the way the whole creation has been designed. So it is not something that needs effort to be put in. It is something that is very natural to all of us. And that beauty we realize as we go through Swami's teachings and messages.
Right, but you know, the moment you say about what Swami says about sealing on desires, when you see desires and curtailing desires and giving up desires, we're almost talking of something which is for a spiritual aspirant. You know, that's the idea which we get, which we hope to prove it is not true. But that's what we generally think, that you know, any idea of cutting down on desires rather than satisfying them is for that category of people who are looking at spiritual gains and not for those general category of people who want to just enjoy their life.
And that is compounded by the fact that if we see modern day propaganda that is going on in the media or anywhere else, it is as if consumption and more consumption is the way to go. An economy is in stress, it is in distress, and the way to get the economy out of that stress and distress is by ensuring greater consumption, inviting more funds, more investment to manufacture more, to consume more. All this makes this concept of curtailing desires or putting a ceiling on desires as something that is of the ordinary and something that is very painful, that means giving up a lot of enjoyment and fun.
Right, but that seems to be the driving force for everything. Like, you know, when you're studying, you are encouraged to have desires, and you are given education as a means to fulfill those desires.
Exactly.
You're encouraged to have desire for a luxurious house and a car and everything, and you're told that this education which you're receiving now is a means to achieve that. And you know, the wiring itself is wrong to start with. I mean, if we accept that having too many desires is the wrong way to go. But that's what is happening. You know, you're always, whatever you take up, you become a sportsman, you're taught how best to earn from that field. You're taught to take up a degree, you're taught what to learn from that.
You know, that is a very pertinent point, and it depends on how we define as what is best. For example, I think it was the Dalai Lama, when he was speaking, he said that you might have got greater technological, I'm not quoting him, but I think this was the message that he was saying, that you might have had so much of technological advances, much greater comforts, things that were never previously imagined. But are people happier than what they were, say, 50 years ago? Recently, I was watching some of the, advertisements that were broadcast in the 1980s. When I was a child and I used to watch, you know, TV in those days was restricted to something like only about 12 to 14 hours a day. The rest of the time there would be color bars and a kind of high pitched tune.
Make sure that you don't switch on the TV during that time.
Technically, actually, why it was put is to assure you that your TV has not gone wrong. The picture tube is working. The sound tube is also working. You know, so that was the reason. But it was like that. And when I was seeing those ads, you know, I became very nostalgic. And the first thought that came to me spontaneously, you know, I made no effort, and it was nothing like a spiritual thought or something. But the first thought that came is, oh my God, how complicated my life has become, you know. How simple life was those days, how carefree and how happy it was. And this is just about 20 years ago that I was thinking of. And this is what the Dalai Lama was hinting also at, how much more has happiness grown. You know, our desires have grown so much. The means to fulfill the desires have grown so much. And what we have achieved is tremendous. If we can see now with a single cell phone, the things that we can do. A cell phone has come to replace more than 100 other objects that we would use. A calculator, a TV, a music system, a storage device, everything. A mailing device, a letter. Cell phone has become everything. But has contentment, satisfaction, peace, happiness grown? Because ultimately that is what every man wants, right? Every person wants to be peaceful, happy and joyful. Has that increased? That in itself should give us a strong hint in showing that there is no correlation as such with increasing consumption and increasing happiness.
But that seems to be quite contrary to the idea, because I remember, if you look at Indian economy and Indian the way we've progressed as an industrial nation, if you look at it, I think we can, as you said, when you see those advertisements, you could see that the products were not as glamorous as they are now. You know, a shampoo used to be much more simplistic in its appearance and in its availability.
And cheap also.
Right. But, you know, now when you look at it, if you look at the time when we were in school, an object, a soap, you know, you used to have two or three brands, and you used to have one or two brands of toothpaste. And there was not any competition in the packaging, if you look at it.
Correct.
And that was one of the reasons why if somebody were, you know, coming from abroad, and if they bring objects from abroad, we would be overawed by the packaging. You know, the amount of stuff which is not the object as such. You know, if you have biscuits, the covering the biscuit comes in, you know, the plastic covering and the box in which it is put, the design which it has, if you take a shoe or something, you know, apart from the object itself, the amount of things which would go to make
that. Apart from how well it fits you. How, what is the styling, what is the shape.
Right. In fact, you know, there is a very marked event which happened during the 1990s, early 1990s. You know, that's when the Indian economy actually opened up to globalization, or at least started doing that. You know, that time, one of the things which were lacking in the Europe and in the Western countries was numbers. You know, they could produce, but there was only a limit on how much they can consume because of the population. You know, the population was less. But in the Asian countries, the population was large. So you had a huge market, but why wasn't growth happening? You know, you didn't have GDP growth as much as in Western countries. So they got some Western economists to see what should be done in India to make its GDP grow. You know, what is the suggestion which was given? You know, the suggestion given to the government was, your people are not spending enough. So the suggestion was to make more malls, more attractive packaging, more brands come in, and you entice people to buy more.
And it seemed to work.
And it did seem to work. I mean, it worked for what they wanted. You know, it did increase the GDP growth. But as you said, you know, to attach GDP just to happiness, I mean, attach happiness just to the growth in GDP, may not have been the complete picture there.
Exactly, because if that had been the case, America should have been the happiest nation on earth today. But it is not, and they are reeling under so many of their own problems. Which shows that, you know, material progress, though is good, now India is also facing it. You know, we had this tremendous growth in the last 10 years maybe, or 11, 12 years. And suddenly now, India doesn't seem to be shining so much. There are so many problems that are cropping up. And this in spite of the fact that the Sensex, which is supposed to be an index to measure how the companies are doing, is at its all-time high. I remember when we were in school, the Sensex would be around 8,000, 9,000, and it was news when it crossed the 10,000 mark. Today, it's at 21,000. And still, the same problems of poverty, of corruption, of all the things that bothered seems to have got compounded even today. Which means definitely there is something that we are missing when we say that greater production and greater consumption is the way to greater happiness and peace. And that is where today's discussion becomes very relevant, and actually Swami makes it so simple. But before we delve deep into that, I think we should start off with that fascinating thing that we read about.
Right, you know, fascinating nonetheless, but scary and disturbing, you know, to put it the other way.
Hmm.
I think it happened with a person called Charles Moore. Charles Moore, he was taking part in a transatlantic sailing race.
Hmm.
You know, and I think there is one point in that Pacific Ocean which is called it's kind of a whirlpool.
Oh, so it's a trans-Pacific or right. Transatlantic race.
Sorry, trans-Pacific.
Uh-huh.
And there is that some kind of a pocket in the Pacific where usually sailors don't go to. Because that's where it's something like an oceanic whirlpool.
It's called an oceanic desert actually. In that part of the ocean, you don't see much life.
Right.
It's almost in the center.
The reason why sailors would never go there is there are currents drawing you towards the center of that point.
Oh, okay.
So that's why they would take a long detour and cross across that part and go.
Oh, like a gigantic
right.
whirlpool.
Yeah. So this person, when he was returning from the race, he just wanted to go through that point.
Mm.
He wanted to have a look how it looks in that area. So that's when he was sailing past that area, he came across this part which you rightly mentioned as...
Exactly. As he was going through that area, he was shocked to see some kind of, you know, a slight shimmer in the water like thing. It was nothing that was seen from on the surface, it seemed like nothing. But on closer investigation, he saw that it was plastic. Plastic pieces floating in the middle of nowhere. In the middle of the ocean where there are no islands, nothing. And these plastic pieces were not just a few stray pieces. A huge area. You know, later on it was found out to be on an average a size of about 800 to 900,000 square kilometers. Which means if you draw a square, this patch of floating plastic was something like 800 kilometers wide and 1,000 kilometers long. A huge area. That huge area of plastic floating in the ocean and occupying up to 5 to 6 meters of the top waters, maybe even more deep it was, and just plastic.
And you know, the interesting thing is he says that, says in an interview, he wants to see what are those plastic objects.
Okay.
Because the first time when he sees this plastic and he has no idea about the size of this whole plastic island, he thinks that most of it would have come from sailors throwing plastic objects offboard.
Okay, yeah, huh.
You know, because
when you consume at sea.
Right, you try to travel as light as possible. You know, you don't want your ship to be bogged down. So he thought it was that, but when he saw, there were many objects which sailors will never carry with them.
Okay.
So that's when he realized that this plastic was just not off ships and boats, but it was also from the shore, from the land.
Dear listeners, today it has been thoroughly studied and you can even Google up. You know, this patch that we are talking about is called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And 5 such patches have already been discovered in the world. And the biggest one, some of the estimates. Some of the estimates say that this is about 15 million square kilometers in size, or twice the size of the United States of America, which means this patch is almost the second largest land, or second largest mass after Russia on the planet Earth. This plastic, they say, has come from land where humans reside. And it has formed this patch because, as Prem said, you know, there are these whirlpools, oceanic whirlpools, which are formed because of oceanic currents. The oceanic currents themselves depend on the winds, the air currents that are created because of differential heating across the globe.
Right.
You know, the equator is heated more, so there is warm air rises and cool air from the sides rushes in. The wind, therefore, the wind system of the world is created, and this wind system of the world influences the water. It's just like, you know, you blowing hard on a glass of water, you see ripples in the water. In the same way, these gigantic winds, huge winds create water currents,
right.
Oceanic currents are created. And
it's actually two currents which happen. One is, as you said, the lateral movement on the surface because of the winds,
mm-hmm.
and also because of the heating level of the water.
Exactly.
In some places, the water is hotter on the surface, and that starts circulating.
Every place, the water is
right.
hotter on the surface because
right.
it gets heat, and so there is a kind of convection current that is
right.
generated.
So all these are creating what they call these oceanic gyres. So these start collecting whatever is there on the surface into small land masses. I mean, not land masses, but islands of those objects.
And yeah, it is almost like a washing machine functioning.
Absolutely.
You know, when you turn the washing machine, you throw the clothes any way you want, but when it's washing, you see all the clothes somehow get accumulated to the center.
Right.
A kind of gigantic washing machine is happening in the oceans, and these plastics and other objects are being gathered into the center. And that was discovered as late as 1997, right?
That think, is what. Yeah, 97. But it's a wonder, you know, with all our satellite technology, how is it that they missed it? It must be not visible from space, right?
That is what. If you see the photographs, the actual photographs, you know, in order to draw attention of the people towards plastic garbage, people, you know, set up and take images of water covered in plastic. But if you see the actual patch, if you take a photograph even from the ship, you cannot see anything. It just looks like a blue desert. Because the plastic does not actually float on top like, you know, like a boat. It is 90% submerged. It's more like an iceberg. So if you go really close to the surface of the water, you can see, but this plastic pervades on an average, they say, about 5 meters thickness in the water. So you can imagine 5 meters is almost like a two-story building.
Right, actually, what happens is, you know, this plastic, especially plastic which can degrade, not biodegrade, but can break up.
Hmm.
It starts breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces, you know, very, very small pieces that cannot be seen from a distance. And what is actually this garbage patch, most of it is something like a plastic soup, you know,
okay.
where the concentration of the plastic in ocean water is remarkably high.
Exactly. And, we might all wonder why is so much discussion on this plastic patch. Well, there are, because it is very pertinent to the subject that we are speaking about, which is sealing on desires. Now, the problem with plastic is, unlike other objects which break down, which are broken down by microorganisms in nature, which are biodegradable. Say, if you peel an orange and throw the orange peels, within 15-20 days, you'll see a mushy and a stinking kind of you can say goo that is accumulated, and that goes away, and after 20 days or 30 days there's nothing. It's completely broken down into its constituent elements.
Right.
So that is the way nature has a cycle. An element, all the elements come together to form organic things such as the human body or an orange or an apple or a tree, and once it falls, the microorganisms work on them, break them down into the smallest constituents, which is back to compounds and finally to elements, and it returns back. But that is not the case with plastic. And in order to explore why this is not the case with plastics, we should go into a little history of how plastic production came to be.
Right. You know, I think it's the idea of plastics was from objects which were natural.
Mm.
You know, what you call long chain organic compounds. That's where the idea was got from, because it was found that, I mean, even in the body, if you see, you have sugars, then the sugars form carbohydrates and carbohydrates form starch. So the endurance level of those long chain compounds are much more than when they are in the form of smaller molecules, which are sugars.
Exactly. And this was found in nature also. And some of the, you know, natural polymers, as they call it, are like rubber.
Right.
You know, rubber was discovered long ago and it was found to be very useful. It was elastic, it was stretchable, it was strong, it was durable. It was an interesting material. And with the vulcanization of rubber, which is adding sulfur to rubber, Charles Goodyear who discovered this fact that when sulfur is added to rubber, it becomes so strong that it gains totally different properties. It's like a difference between man and Superman.
Right.
Rubber becomes super rubber, vulcanized rubber, and it can now be used in making automobile tires. It can carry tons of weight on it without getting broken. Right. I mean, even the pencil eraser is made of rubber, and we have a car wheel that is made of rubber, a tire made of rubber, but there is so much difference between the two rubbers.
Right. You have aircraft wheels are made of...
aircraft tires are made of rubber, exactly. So, man discovered that even in many of these naturally occurring polymeric molecules, if we introduce some kind of chemicals and some sort of substances, they get strengthened and they get superhuman qualities. Not superhuman qualities, like Superman qualities.
Supernatural.
Supernatural qualities, exactly. And that is how plastics came into being. And when plastic came, it was a miracle. It was a marvel. Because here was something that did not rust like iron and other metals. That did not rust and break away. It was not as heavy as other metals. Like, you know, they made alloys in order to overcome rusting in metals. But even these alloys were very heavy. So here was a drum, let's say, that was 1/4 the weight of a metal drum, but which was much more durable than a metal drum.
Right.
Because it would not get rusted, nothing would happen.
It
was light.
It's easy to shape.
It's easy to shape and make different shapes. And it is amazing in every sense. In fact, today in the automobile industry, almost 80% of the car is made up of some sort of polymer or the other. Metal has been almost totally discarded. And that's why, you know, that's the other hazard. Well, when accidents happen, cars get mashed beyond recognition. But well, as plastic became useful and more useful, its growth proliferated all around the world.
Right. You know, that's where the idea of the packaging, the various substances also started, you know, because you could add layers and layers of plastic in the name of package, and that was adding attractiveness to the things which you were selling. And, you know, all it just went into one point after the other.
And it proliferated. I mean, in the sense, why are we making tables out of wood? Let's make it out of plastic. Plastic tables. Why are we making cars out of metal? Let's make it out of plastic. 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 Almost everything that man made, he saw that if it can be made with plastic, it's going to be cheaper, easier, quicker to make. And you know, you can get colors. It's difficult, you know, in metals also there are some colors. In plastic, the range of colors available was so much. So the amount of options that plastic gave, the choice that plastic gave was so tremendous that it began to be used for everything. Everything today, we look around, we can't live without plastic. That is how plastic proliferated, because it was good.
And I think that's where the problem started. Because man started using plastic because it was not easily... You cannot break it down easily, but now that itself became the nemesis of plastic. Because now the question is, okay, after you use the object, how do I dispose it now? You know, everything, even if you look at our console here,
the computers, our cell phone, our microsystem, mic systems.
The wires, everything has a lot of plastic in it. But now once the usage of that object is over,
it's obsolete.
Where do I dump it?
Yes, we dump it in landfills, we throw it into drains, which carry it to the rivers, which take it to the ocean, which has led to formation of garbage patches, which measure 15 million square kilometers, which is mind-boggling. See the amount of waste we have created.
And it's growing every year.
It's growing, yes. It's growing at an alarming rate every year. And you know, plastic has affected in ways that are beyond imagination. For example, you know, we spoke of how plastic breaks down. It doesn't decompose like an orange peel, but it breaks into tiny, 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 like micro tiny bits, which are ingested by microorganisms, which doesn't get digested. And these are eaten by bigger organisms, by bigger organisms. So, how does it affect? It's all, after all, a little bit. What happens is, when a bird is eating a fish, the fish would have eaten a lot of these tiny organisms which contain plastic. The organism is digested, but the plastic remains in the fish.
Right.
In a greater quantity now. Now, when the bird eats the fish is digested, but the plastic in the fish remains in the bird. And in a year, a bird will eat, say, about 100 fish. So, 100 times the concentration of plastic builds up in the fish, in the bird. And you know, the shocking thing is, albatrosses, the most beautiful birds in the world, with a huge wingspan, they look like flying aircraft. Mm-hmm. Amazing sight. It has happened in such a manner that, you know, these birds are so huge, with such a huge wingspan that, like normal birds that we see, they don't take off directly.
Okay.
They run for about 8 to 9 meters. Mm-hmm. They need it, like almost like an aircraft takeoff. They need that runway and then they pick off. Birds, albatrosses have died because of starvation. Why? Because they are unable to fly. Why? Because they are unable to take off. Why? Because they are being held down by the weight of plastic in their stomach.
My God.
That is one thing. And they have found many skeletons of albatrosses.
And the thing is, the bird is not eating plastic.
Exactly. It's eating fish.
It's eating its natural food.
And there have been many skeletons of these albatrosses found where, you know, the bone is rotting, the flesh has completely been degraded. The bone is now starting to degenerate.
Okay.
Which means it must be at least about 20-30 year old. But the plastics in the stomach are still looking pristine and clear. It has not even started to break down. The cause of the death is still there, available to kill more birds. And as we spoke about, you know, a lot of chemicals are added into these plastics. So what happens is, though the plastic does not break down, the enzymes in the stomachs of these organisms start leaching out the chemicals that are there in the plastic, which have been added to make plastic durable.
Okay.
These chemicals play havoc in the biological systems of the birds. One example is, I forget the name of the bird, but several species of birds, because of leaching of chemicals, mm-hmm. got affected in such a manner that the eggshells became brittle. Which means as the bird is laying the egg is breaking, cracking. And when it cracks, the child inside can no longer grow. The population of that bird is getting wiped out. All this is because of plastic poisoning. I mean, plastic pollution, you just have to Google it to see that it has become a real menace beyond our wildest imagination. And there's a great need. That's why these Go Green campaigns are starting. There's a great need. And it is not as if it is localized. The oceans are everywhere and they have spread. It doesn't matter if you say that in our country we don't use plastic. Because the world is using plastic, you get affected. The world has almost become like one single organism where any place is affected is going to affect the whole world. That's happening in economies, that's happening even in plastic.
I think that's what's happened with this patch, because definitely this is not one country's contribution of plastic. It's from all the continents, and it's just that the oceans are just doing their job as they've been doing all these years. They're just collecting waters from different areas and mixing it up. And that's what gives biodiversity to the oceans also. So what it's doing is, you know, the countries, the developing countries and the developed countries may be using more plastic, but the fishes which are in the shores of the African countries also will get affected because of this.
Everybody gets affected. And, you know, this brings into light one very, very, very important point. A point about what is good and what is bad. Plastic is something that is wonderful, that's beautiful, that is good, because it had so many properties. It started off as something that is very good. But today, it is something that is poisonous, it's harmful, it is devastating. Something that is good has become bad over the passage of time. Which means, you know, there's nothing like an absolute good or an absolute bad. Something that is good can become bad, something that's bad can become good. But one thing we can safely say is that everything is in its limit. And anything when it goes beyond a certain limit, beyond the tipping point, it becomes bad. Extreme is bad. Limit is good. I think that is one thing that becomes very clear with the plastic example. Plastic within limits is good, is helpful, is necessary. But beyond a certain limit, it becomes bad. So, that gives us a new definition of good and bad. Extremes are bad, limits are good. Don't you think so?
Right, you know, it's a very pertinent point. It also gives the idea that even when you start something, when you produce something, or you discover, invent something, you have to be always conscious of the fact that how long is it good? And the ability to recall and detach yourself from that when you realize that it has lived out its goodness. You know, that's what we have failed to do with plastics, I feel. You know, because this garbage patch, it was predicted at least 30 years ago. You know, scientists who didn't see it actually predicted that this was going to happen in the ocean.
30 years before it was actually discovered.
But, you know, the inability to roll back something which you have started, I think, has caused this. And that is because, you know, we've just been on auto mode. You know, something is given to us, we use it. And we just go on with that. I think that's the whole problem.
It reminds one of that glorious character in Mahabharata, Abhimanyu, who said that I know how to get in and break this formation, the army military formation, but I have no idea how to get out.
Yeah, there's a formation of the Chakravyuha.
Exactly. It looks like all of mankind is almost like that. We know how to get into new things, but we just don't know how to get out of it when it becomes a problem. That's why Abhimanyu lost his life in the Chakravyuha, and it seems as if in all our problems, we too are headed that way.
Very true.
I'm reminded of one small experiment, if we can say so, that was done in an awareness class in the Satsai Institute of High Learning, you know. Gulab Jamun, it's a kind of sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us love it. You know, it's wonderful to eat, and in the hostel, when they serve us during lunchtime, they give us only one. And we often try to, you know, sneak and try to take a second Gulab Jamun, or, you know, it's almost like that. Because it is so tasty, and one is never enough to satisfy us. So in the class, the best eater, a big foodie, he is called as a for a demonstration. And he is asked, would you like to eat one Gulab Jamun or two? He says, wow, two is better than one. So he is given two Gulab Jamuns, which he swallows. And then, you know, this happened. It was a live event. All of us are seeing. He says, will you have one more? He says, wow, yeah, nice. He says, one more. He's a big foodie, you know, so he keeps eating, and Prem, he ate almost 10 Gulab Jamuns.
Okay.
But when the 11th was offered to him, he said, oh, no, I think I'll stop, because, you know, he feels too much is not good. No, it's one day, just eat it. He eats 11, 12. You know, one better or two better, he chose two. Two better or four better, he chose four. Four better or eight better, he chose eight. Eight better or 16 better, he's thinking now. He says, you know, I think 16 may be a bit too much. Okay, 16 better or 32 better, now he has no doubts. 16 is better, not 32. How? How when Gulab Jamun is something that is good and something that you like, you felt that more is always better, how after a point you feel that it is bad? How can 2 be better, how can 4 be better than 2, but 32 not be better than 16? Hey, come on. He said that it is common sense, don't you realize that? Beyond a point you can't eat, it becomes terrible after that. In fact, if I eat any more now, I'll get nauseated when I see Gulab Jamun. Again, that also highlights the same thing that we discussed when it comes to plastic, that everything is good within a limit. Once it crosses a limit, it becomes bad. Extremes are bad, limits are good.
Right, and it's quite contrary to what we always want in life, you know.
Mm.
We want limitless of everything. And we always say that, you know, let the person who is using choose the limits. That's something which we always say.
Trusting the discrimination of the person.
Trusting the discrimination of the person, but that's something which has definitely not worked out, and I think we've learnt it in many ways that it doesn't work. In fact, Swami, this very example which you gave, it was a practical experiment which was done. But Swami says that the human body is a limited company.
Mm.
He said there needs to be some limits in it. And one of the most beautiful examples that Swami gives is, take the example of temperature.
Mm.
You know, he says it has to be 98.4. If it goes less, then you're hospitalized. If it goes more, then you need medical treatment. And the same thing with pressure too. You have low BP.
Blood pressure. Huh.
Blood pressure. He said low BP, you have to put on medication. High BP, you have to put on medication. It's almost like, you know, there is that sacred golden middle path.
Exactly, Prem.
Left,
you know,
or right of that is dangerous.
Yeah, anything. Anything regarding the human body. You take, for example, the sugar in the blood. You know, if you say that high sugar is bad, you know, it's diabetic, it'll lead to so many complications. Low sugar is equally bad.
Right.
You'll fall unconscious, you're not able to have energy. So, neither, you cannot say that low is good or high is bad. No, no, no. It has to be in a limit. And as you beautifully said, Swami says that the human body is a limited company.
The other wonderful example that Swami used to give, and I'm just clicking that, is
Swami
would say, you see, when somebody takes a photograph, when the flash comes, involuntarily you close your eyes. Swami says, see, because even more light your eye cannot take. Less light also your eye struggles, more light also your eye struggles.
Same thing with sound.
Right.
You're watching a TV program, if it is a little low volume, it'll increase it. Because you feel that a higher volume is better than a lower volume, but if it exceeds certain decibel point, you say, hey, turn down the TV. Even though it might be your favorite program, you tell them to turn it down because the sound level is irritating. So everything about the human body is limited company, and that's the case in nature too. You will never see in a forest the proliferation of one species at the cost of other. There are checks and balances at every stage, and even the ruler, even the lions are not spared. Everything, the number is kept under a certain control so that there's overall equilibrium.
You know, even as you were talking about sound and all that, the only thing which is striking me is, it's very obvious we cannot take loud sound. But don't you realize that now, as such, people are going towards louder and louder, at least music, if not sound. You know, it just comes to the point that your body knows what's the limit, what the limits are. You know, the body has been made by God in the sense that it knows when it's not in order. You know, when we spoke about temperature and pressure. But when you talk about something like sound and light, it comes to the point of what the mind decides is the optimal. You know, that is where this question of Swami telling, controlling the desires comes in, because that comes in the realm of the mind. It goes beyond the body level, because when you gave that Gulab Jamun example, the body knows when to retract. It says, no, this is what I cannot take.
Yeah, the body will say stop at around 8 maybe.
But before that happened, before that point happened when the body retracted, the mind actually thought that there was no limit.
Exactly.
You know, so that thing of controlling or regulating is actually in the mental level.
Beautiful, Prem, because as you say, you know, at 8 I think his body gave up. It said enough, 8 jamuns are enough. But you know, his mind longed for it.
The mind must have told that he won't get this opportunity again.
So exactly. So he was ready to go up to 16. But after that, I think, you know, it hits. It's just because the body refuses and starts, you know, giving adverse reactions that he stops. But if the body had not reacted adversely, if he had not got the vomiting sensation, if he had not got that feeling of fullness, I think the mind would have gone on. There would be no end.
It's a very beautiful thing, because initially you mentioned that it's like the whole world is an organism. And if you apply this understanding which you've got to that, see, intellectually still people are thinking that yes, we can go ahead now. You know, we can still progress because the earth will manage. But it's coming to the point where the earth's body is beginning to tell that no, it doesn't work that way.
Exactly. And I feel these garbage patches are nothing but nausea by the earth.
Absolutely.
Just throwing out and throwing up. And, you know, recently in India, I think it's worldwide also maybe, there is a book that became a bestseller called the Shiva Trilogy.
Right.
It is written by a young, I think, engineer from India, Amish Tripathi.
Right.
He wrote three books on Shiva. It's amazing.
Very contemporary style.
Very contemporary style, and he has interpreted beautifully for most part the Vedas, the Shastras, the ancient scriptures of India in a modern context. It's a beautiful story, riveting, gripping. But you know, throughout, the one message that comes out strongly after you read the 1,500 or 2,000 pages of all the three parts together is this. That you know, in the story there's something called the somaras, or the nectar of immortality, which is supposed to give you long life and wonderful health and all the good things in life. If you consume it, you will not get affected by disease, your eyesight will remain good. When you first start reading the book, you feel that this is the ultimate thing that anybody will want for. You know, in the Harry Potter movie series, it's been shown as the philosopher's stone that will grant you eternal life.
Right.
So eternal life and eternal youth is something that people have longed for from long, and therefore when you get it, it seems to be the most perfect thing. But when you reach the end of the third part, you know what the Lord Shiva does? Shiva's only goal in life is to destroy all the manufacturing plants which are doing somras and destroy the knowledge of the somras. So you wonder, how did this come about? And it is in the three books that he gradually develops this philosophy that there is nothing like good and bad in the universe. Something that is created starts off as good. And that good is nourished and fostered, and because it is good. And it grows and grows and grows, but there is a limit. When it crosses that line, the thing that was good starts becoming bad. But if you are so attached to that thing, if your attachment is to the object, you turn a blind eye to the fact that it's becoming bad, and you continue to proliferate it till it grows to such an extent where you have no choice but to cut it down. Just like plastic has happened. We turn a blind eye, we think no problem and continue, but a point comes where your life will start getting endangered if you don't reduce plastic, you have to cut plastic. And that is what happens. And he says that is, you know, that is what God is all about. You know, he is the one who inspires something beautiful, and that good he sustains, but when it goes beyond limit, he destroys. And that is what Swami also says. God stands for G-O-D, which is generator, organizer and destroyer. I mean, that was such a profound thought, such a simple thought also. But again, it highlights the same truth that we are discussing, that there's nothing like good and bad. Extremes are bad. In limits, it's good.
In fact, that is the understanding which Buddha is supposed to have come before he attained the enlightenment. You know, he goes through that period of complete self-abnegation. He refuses food, refuses sleep, and he grows into a skeletal figure. Mm. And that's when he says that what I'm doing, I've got it all wrong. You know, what is important is the middle path. And it's something which each one of us can relate to. You know, just like how eating too much is going to upset your stomach, and you know when your stomach is upset, you start behaving cranky. The same thing happens when you refuse to your body also. You know, that's what he found, and each one of us can experiment it for ourselves. You know, when you don't have food, you think more of food than of God.
Exactly.
If that is what is happening to you when you're doing upavasa, then it's no point. Stop doing the upavasa.
Neither fasting is good nor feasting is good.
Right.
The middle path. I think, Prem, you know, we have reached a very interesting point in our discussion. We will take it forward. But before that, maybe we'll take a small break.
Sure.
Dear listeners, we'll be back. We'll continue further on how the ceiling on desires is an integral part of our life, well-being and our progress in every manner after this break. So continue to be tuned in. We'll be back very soon.
मंदिर है भगवान का, पानी उसका, भूमि उसी की, सब कुछ उसी महान का, नाए तेरा, नाए मेरा, नाए मेरा। हम सब खेल खिलौने उसके, खेल रहा सरताज रे, खेल रहा सरताज रे, उसकी ज्योति सब में दम के, सब में उसका प्यार रे, सब में उसका प्यार रे, मन मंदिर में दर्शन कर ले उन प्राणों का, प्राण का, पानी उसका, भूमि उसी की, सब कुछ उसी महान का, नाए तेरा, नाए मेरा, नाए मेरा। जाए मंदिर जाए, अनगिन देव मनाए रे, अनगिन देव मनाए रे, दीन रूप में राम सामने, देखे नयन फिराए रे, देखे नयन फिराए रे, मन की आंखें खुल जाए तो क्या करना हमें ज्ञान का, पानी उसका, भूमि उसी की, सब सब कुछ उसी महान का, ना ये तेरा ना ये मेरा, मंदिर है भगवान का। पानी उसका भूमि उसी की, सब कुछ उसी महान का, सब कुछ उसी महान का, सब कुछ उसी महान का।
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are discussing a topic of sealing on desires, because we have not come to what Swami has to say about sealing on desires, and that's indeed the most interesting part. But so far what we've understood is that, you know, something which is good and something which has been beneficial ceases to be beneficial beyond a certain point. And that is where the importance of the golden middle path comes out.
Speaking of which, Prem, it reminds me of an incident that took place when I was in my 11th standard,
okay,
studying in a school. At that time, I had this great desire to be, you know, physically get into form, or, you know, get attention from Swami.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that the best way to achieve that would be to stay back for the vacation, winter vacation. Simply because of statistics. You know, out of 500 people, if 400 go home, only 100 stays back. Swami's darshan remains the same. So now Swami's darshan is to be shared only by 100 people instead of 400. So there's a greater chance of you getting a chance to interact or speak with Swami or something like that. And this was my conviction, that if I stayed back for the vacation, if I, in quotes, sacrificed my vacation for Swami's sake, Swami would reward my sacrifice. That was my feeling. That was my conviction, and it came true in a very interesting manner. How it happened was, I had carried my camera to the mandir, like I always do, and I was sitting with the students, and Swami called a group in for interview. And it was such a huge group, they might be about, I think, 45 to 50 men and about 60 women. So the interview room would not suffice, so Swami gave them an interview in the bhajan hall. All the doors of the bhajan hall and the windows were shut. Swami spoke to them. About half an hour, 45 minutes later, the doors opened and the ladies exited from the ladies' side, gents from the gents' side. Swami walked into the interview room. At that point in time, one of the men, he comes walking up to the students' block. Of all the people, he comes to me straight and he says, Swami told me to tell you to take a group photograph,
mm-hmm,
of our group. And he pointed towards the gents' side where the group, where all the gents who had received the interview were now slowly gathering. So I thought, what is this strange request? I felt that, you know, he must have asked Swami for a group photograph, and Swami would have told, yeah, ask the students there. Because, you know, I felt there is no way Swami knows me. He's no way Swami would have told, there is one boy with a camera, his name is Arvind.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that he just took a random chance. He saw four of us sitting with a camera, he came to me. Now, those were not digital, that was not the digital age, so it was the film camera.
Right.
So which means after taking a picture, you have to get the film developed, then you have to make prints. It's a tedious process. But anyway, I thought that if he says so, let me go and take a picture. So I told him, gather your group and form a proper group there. I will come take a photo and come back. That was the thing. So he went there and started arranging the group. When he was doing it, I got up from my place. I was already feeling a little special. You know, I thought, who knows, Swami might have actually told him.
Mm-hmm.
And why Swami would have told about me? Maybe because among the four of us sitting here, maybe I am the best photo, I am the better photographer among us four. So, you know, that is why maybe Swami told me. And I was feeling good about it. And I was walking towards this group. To my shock, imagine, there is a hush. And to my right, there is Swami, who has walked out of the interview room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's about 5 meters behind me. So immediately I sat down. Swami continued to walk. Swami went and stood with the group. That is when I realized what it was. You know, Swami was granting a group photograph. And wow, so I got up and I took a picture. I sat back in my place. And then Swami started to walk again. And this time, he looked at me and he said, are you a student? I said, yes, Swami. Swami said, go sit on the lady's side. I thought Swami was joking, you know, why would he tell me to go to the lady's side? He said that and started walking. Now, I did not know what to do, so I got up. And those were not the days when there would be people walking behind Swami.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1998 and Swami used to walk alone. So now, here was a student walking behind Swami. And I was walking behind Swami because I had no idea what to do. Midway again Swami stopped, turned to me and said, "Not with me. Go and sit in lady's side." I was shocked. I was thinking, what is this? I thought Swami is still joking. But since Swami told it sternly, I just started walking. I didn't have the courage to go to the lady's side. So I went and stood near the interview room. That is the borderline between the ladies and the gents side. I stood at the interview room and did not know what to do. Swami in the meanwhile passed across the students and he was entering the ladies side of the Kulwant Hall. He looked at me. I was standing at the interview room door. He told me, "Ladies side," and he pointed to the ladies side. He said, "Oh, come over there." That was when it struck me that he was wanting to grant a photograph, a group photograph to the ladies group as well. Mm-hmm. I was so dumb. I did not realize what was happening. So I rushed. Now a new problem came. What was it? Swami is posing, Swami is standing, all the ladies are seated, and as Swami is posing for the picture, the group of ladies is so wide that they are not fitting in the lens. I need to go more back to take the image. But I can't go more back because there are ladies seated there also, the devotees who are seated there. I did not know what to do, and you know, Swami read my mind. These are small instances he shows of his, you know, omniscience. He just looked beyond me to the ladies and said, "Make a path." And just like the ocean parted for Moses to go through, just like the river parted for Nanda to carry Krishna on his head, the ladies immediately parted and made a path. And I went deep inside, at least 20-30 lines inside, and from there the whole group I was able to get. So I took a picture. And then I went to him, Swami said, "Get the pictures tomorrow." And I returned back to my seat and everybody was looking up at me, you know, telling, wow. This was a privilege that only, you know, they said that Swami's, the photographers whom Swami considers as his own, only to them he gives this privilege. And that's it. I was on cloud 9. And unknown to me, my ego rose to superhuman heights. I became so, you know, like, I felt like I'm a star. I need to get all the attention. And, you know, two teachers I remember from the school, Venkatesh Varlu sir and Satish Babu sir, they so lovingly, they spent the money and made, you know what they did? They took one print of each photograph, mm-hmm. counted the number of gents and number of ladies, made that many copies and neatly tied it with a ribbon, gave it to me and said, "Give it to Swami. If Swami asks, how did you get it, say that you didn't spend any money. And then if Swami asks, where did the money come from, you just tell everything is Swami's only. Don't even mention our names." That was their humility. And I felt that Swami made them say that to me in order for me to imbibe that humility. But I was lost in my own world. I said, okay, I took it. And you know my arrogance, Prem, I went and told one of my classmates that if you want to take Padnamskar, sit next to me. Why? Because Swami is going to stop and talk to me. When he's talking to me, you can take Padnamskar. That was my ego, you know. So I was sitting there in the mandir, absolutely sure that Swami is going to come to me and inquire about the photos, because he said that he would ask about it the next day. He totally ignored me. He was on my side of the carpet till he came to me. The minute he neared me, he crossed the carpet, went to the other side, totally ignored me. I tried 2-3 other places. Everywhere I was ignored in the same way, till that same classmate of mine comes back to me and asks, "What happened?" If I had sat next to you, I don't think I would have even seen Swami from close quarters. And that hit me, you know, I felt so bad. I went and sat in the veranda where later on the car used to be parked. Mm-hmm. That time the students used to be allowed to sit there. I sat in one corner, sitting and telling Swami, "I have been so stupid, I have been so egoistic, I am such a fool, you know, I realized the truth." I was feeling so bad about it. Swami comes out and starts talking to the warden. As he's speaking to the warden, I'm trying to show the photographs. Swami is not looking at it at all. And then my heart says, you know, you felt so egoistic, you felt so important about yourself, and that is why you have been deflated. So, Swami will not accept. Then I said, yes. And you know, I started cursing myself. I said, "Arvind, you're the most low kind of fellow. You're the most idiotic fellow. You're the most..." I scolded, abused myself. And in that self-abuse, I opened the cover and put the photos back into the cover. The cover made a slight kind of sound, crushing sound, and Swami turned to me and asked, "Hey, what is that?" I was now, you know, very meek, in a full demeaning mode, self-condemning mode. So I said, Swami, nothing Swami, it is just some photos. Which photos? Swami, yesterday you told to take. And then Swami's whole face lit up. Oh, yesterday's photos, why didn't you tell me, why didn't you show me, I've been waiting for this. And then I'm thinking, oh, what do I say? Swami says, you come here. So I gave him the photos. He took the photos and started walking out. This was a portico, nobody could see from outside. So he took the photos and started walking to the outer veranda. And he turns back and says, you also come here. So I was thinking, what do I have to do? So I go there and now I'm standing with Swami in the full public view of the whole hall. And then Swami stands and with his finger beckons to the leader of that group, who from the gent side comes running. He was the person who had told me that Swami has told to take a photo. He comes running and Swami gives him photographs and says, see this boy, how perfectly he has done. Good photographer he is. And then gives him and says, what are these? I tell Swami that, Swami, this is a group photos of the gents. So as if it is not visible, Swami tells him, hey, understood? This is gents group photos. And what is this? Swami, ladies group photos. See, these are ladies group photos. And Swami gives it to him. And then Swami blesses him and tells, go. He suddenly turns to Swami and says, Swami, can I have the negatives, please? You know, Swami was taken aback. He didn't expect this. So he just turned towards me. And for some reason, I had it in my pocket, you know. Those two negatives of the two group photos. Okay. I had cut it and put it in a plastic cover and I had got it. I said, Swami, I have the negatives here. Again, Swami gave such a beautiful smile and said, see, boy is so intelligent. He is ready with everything. Take your negatives and off you go. And then Swami turned, gave me Padnamaskar and sent me back. And you know, I felt when I got very egoistic, you know, Swami brought me down. That time I felt that, you know, this ego is so bad. This kind of feeling good about yourself is bad. And therefore I had gone to the other extreme, which is self-condemnation. And when that happened, Swami again brought and, you know, praised me. And that is when I realized that, you know, you cannot say that praising is good or condemning is good. Praising is bad or condemning is bad. Anything in the extreme is bad. And therefore I felt that when I went to the extreme on one side, Swami gave the opposite treatment. And when I went to the extreme on the other side, Swami gave this opposite treatment. So again, you know, it reinforced in me that the middle path is the way to go. Extremes are bad. Limits are good.
You know, Swami used to give this example in the earlier years, in the 60s and 70s. Swami would say, I am like the mother elephant which is teaching the baby elephant to walk. And Swami would say, the baby elephant would be confined within the four legs of the mother elephant. You know, it has to walk under the mother elephant as the mother walks.
And practice.
Swami would say that if the baby elephant takes to the left and tries to move out, it'll get a kick from the left. If it tries to move out through the side, it'll get a kick from the right.
Wow. Yeah, we have seen this happening.
Right. And Swami would say, that's how I take care of my devotees. I teach them to live in life.
Now, don't go to any extremes.
Right. That's the idea I got when I heard this narrated by you.
And you know, this example, even I think Swami narrates as a Chinnakatha, right, of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Brahmananda and Vivekananda.
Right. You know, I think that incident where suddenly Ramakrishna Paramahamsa says, I want to eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he says, I want to eat fish. And from where they are staying, they have to cross the river and go to the market and buy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Brahmananda is the first one who is sent. And when he goes, and typically I think... As it is said, no messiah is accepted in his land. And as the adage goes, nobody in that region actually had a lot of reverence for Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. And they used to look at these people and demean them by saying that, why are you wasting your time and your youth under a master who is a madcap? So that's what happens when he is going in that boat. Everybody in the boat starts, pulling his leg and making fun of him. So Brahmananda is so hurt because he loves his master so much, so he starts crying. So he comes back and nobody gives him fish also in the market. Nobody is ready to sell that fish. So when he comes back, he's in tears and he's very sad with what has happened. So Ramakrishna asks him, what happened? Why are you crying and where's the fish? So he narrates the whole incident, and then after that Ramakrishna starts shouting at him and he says, you know, if you really have love for the master, will you keep quiet if somebody is talking ill of him? And, you know, will you keep quiet if your mother is being spoken ill of and all that? And Vivekananda is a witness to this whole scene. And he's saying that, you know, what a fool this guy is, spineless fellow. If I had been there, I would have, you know, taught him a befitting lesson. So immediately, Ramakrishna turns to Vivekananda and says, tomorrow you get some fish. So this whole episode repeats, and Vivekananda is there in the boat. Of course, he's not yet Vivekananda, he's Naren. And there these people start talking ill of the master. And I think he even goes and hits them.
He throws one person into the river, actually.
Yeah, throws one person off board, and, you know, he's very wild and everybody's scared. And this time he gets back the fish. And then again, Ramakrishna asks, what happened in the market today? So when triumphantly Vivekananda is narrating this whole incident, Ramakrishna says, you know, are you a monk? Are you a disciple of mine? You know, how can you talk? How can you lose your temper like this? And, you know, gives him a good piece of advice. And Vivekananda is so confounded. He says, you know, yesterday you spoke like this and today you're talking like this. You know, what is right? You know, do we react or should we be passive? What is the right thing? And then Swami says, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa tells Vivekananda and Brahmananda, he says, it is like the air in a tire. You know, in his tire, it was less, so I had to pump. In yours, it is too much, so I have to release some.
Exactly. And we observe it when we drive our vehicles on a day-to-day basis, Prem, you know. If there's too much air also, the shock-absorbing capacity of the tire goes down and you feel every bump and jerk. If there's too less air, there's a chance of the tube of the tire getting punctured. So you need the optimum amount of air. Again, the middle path.
Right.
Too much is too bad of either way, you know, deprivation or having.
And, you know, that's where this idea of ceiling on desires comes. Because Swami, I think it was the 10th conference of the organization.
World conference.
Not world conference, the All India Organization conference. That's where Swami introduced this as one of the charters of the organization. Swami said, let's start this program called the ceiling on desires.
He never said giving up of desires.
Right. That's the interesting thing. He didn't say give up all desires. Of course, maybe Swami would have lost a few thousand people if Swami had said that. But Swami interestingly said ceiling on desires, and as I said, the 10th meeting. And also, once I think the satsang, we spoke about the 9 points code of conduct which Swami has given the organization.
9 point code of conduct, yes.
Right. The 9th point in that is ceiling on desires.
You know, I'm reminded of an example of how, I think again this Swami has narrated, of how people catch monkeys, how these monkey catchers catch monkeys. He says that, you know, in a bottle, a bottle has a bottleneck.
Right.
So in a bottle they fill peanuts, ground nuts, whatever that the monkey likes, and they leave it out in the open. The monkey comes and puts...
It's actually buried in the ground. So that the pot as such is immovable.
Exactly, the pot or bottle is immovable, correct. And then inside it are the peanuts and groundnuts that the monkey likes. The monkey puts its paw inside and it tries to grab as much of the food as it can. When it takes so many peanuts in its paw, the paw now becomes big that it can't come out of
the neck
of the bottle or the pot. And the monkey thinks that the pot has caught hold of it. If only the monkey takes only one peanut or two peanuts, the paw will not be so big it can pull it out. But the monkey never seems to learn. And it always tries to grab as much as possible, because of which it gets stuck. And it feels that the pot is holding on to me, not realizing that it is actually it that is holding on to the pot.
Right, you know, it's a very, very graphic and interesting analogy which Swami has given. Because one thing, as you said, the pot is not holding on to the monkey. And the second thing is, not even the desire is actually holding the monkey. It is only that excessive desire which is holding the monkey.
Exactly. It wants ground nuts, no problem.
Yes. Even if it takes one or two, it's not going to be held there.
Correct. You know, I think what happens with the monkey also happens with our monkey mind. That the mind is not satisfied with limits. And, you know, it is, if you say be in limits, it's considered like a pessimistic statement. All the inspiring talks, so-called modern day talks, are all about breaking all barriers, going beyond all limits. The sky is the limit. If the sky is the limit, what will happen to the planet? You know, because another example that Swami gives is, if you want a heap of sand, you have to dig the ground. And Swami says, when you have a heap of sand of say 1 foot high, corresponding to it is a depression that is 1 foot deep. Because earth is not made from infinite resources. So if there is an excess in one side, remember there's a lack at some other point also. So the greater the excess, the greater is the lack, the greater is the disparity, the greater is the imbalance, and therefore the greater the chances of some catastrophe or balancing act about to happen.
Right. In fact, you know, even if you look at what is described as the purusharthas, it is said that dharma, artha, kama, moksha, you can have a desire to earn, but it is just that limit. You know, going back to Swami's Sailing on Desires program, when he started it, he gave it four dimensions. He said, not wasting money, not wasting food, not wasting energy, and not wasting money.
Time.
Right, money I've already mentioned. So these are the four things. And if you look at it, Swami never discouraged people from earning money or accumulating wealth. But it was misuse of money which Swami was referring to even in the Sailing of Desires program. You know, one of the beautiful examples which Swami gives is like, you know, the size of a shoe. What Swami would say that if it is too big, it's going to hurt the leg. If it's too small, again, it's going to hurt the leg.
Yeah, if it's too small, it'll bite. If it's too big, it'll trip you.
Right.
So either way, it hurts you. But it has to be the correct size. What you said is very pertinent, because you can't live without money, you can't live without time, food. That's why Swami says, don't waste food and time. Swami never says that food, energy, money and time are evil. Misuse is bad. You know, that again comes to limit, and therefore, you know, in some, within the limit, there are needs. We need food, we need energy, we need time, we need money. But when they become desire, I remember Professor Anil Kumar, while giving a talk, he gave a beautiful example. He said, we need water. Yes, we can't live without water. But you know, now I want distilled water. Then I want Bisleri water. I want Aquafina water. Finally, there's a brand, I think it's called Evian or something like that, where it's atrociously costly. A liter of bottled water is 10 times the price of fuel, gasoline. Now, wanting that is a desire. Wanting water is a need. Of course, with this, you know, again, the professor beautifully elucidates. He says that you may think that I am trying to suggest that we have a low standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't I have pure bottled water? Why should I drink normal water? That is only for the low standard of living. But you know, scientifically it has been proved that it is not so. For example, a case to point which has happened in Puttaparthi itself. In the Prashant Nilayam hostel, you know, a devotee in his eagerness to serve Swami wanted to set up a reverse osmosis water unit. Which means now that because of this reverse osmosis unit, every drop of water that they get is as good as Bisleri or mineral water. Pure drinking water, which is a thrill, which is magnificent. Okay, so much now, the whole hostel has got used to it so much that, you know, one of the research scholars was telling me that once when this reverse osmosis unit had a breakdown, so for 2 days they had to go back to their old method, which is normal filtered water, which is get the groundwater, filter it and drink it. In those 2 days, more than 100 students suffered from diarrhea, which had never been the case before. And if we see more and more of these, we realize that by drinking that ultra pure water, you know, you have lost your immunity. In fact, there was another study which said that those children who have grown up playing in mud and sand turn out to be healthier and better children than those who have never touched sand and mud in their life. So you see, you can't say bacteria is bad, microorganism is bad. Yes, in an extreme it's bad because it causes infection. But even that is needed in limits. And that is what Swami is saying, that everything is needed in limits. And therefore, you know, the professor was saying that, you know, it is not the question of standard of living, but the question of quality in life. We have to improve the quality of life and not just standard of living. So therefore, he clearly differentiates between a need and a desire. And he says, need is fine. Swami never says no to needs. Yes, your needs have to be fulfilled. But desires put a ceiling.
Right. You know, one way of looking at it is, your life can depend on needs. You know, you need air, you need water, you need food. So your existence or your living can depend on these things. But the whole problem comes when your life starts depending on desires. You know, that's where all the confusion comes in. That's where all these excesses have happened.
Exactly. This is in fact in the Bhagavad Gita, the second shloka, the second chapter in Sankhya Yoga, shloka 62 and 63. Lord Krishna beautifully explains, you know, how desire is the root cause for everything. All the Arshad Vargas, you know, Swami describes six enemies of man: Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madamatsaryam.
Right.
Anger, greed, lust, desire, attachment. And Lord Krishna says how desire is the root cause for all of these.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just read out these two shlokas. You know, Lord Krishna says, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsa Sangas Te Shupajayate Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha Kamat Krodho Vijayate Krodat Bhavati Sammoha Sammohat Smriti Vibhramaha Smriti Bhramshat Buddhinasho Buddhinashat Pranashyati.
Okay, I think the meaning goes like this. While contemplating the objects of the senses, a person develops attachment for them. And from such attachment, lust develops. And from lust, anger arises. From anger, complete delusion arises. And from delusion, bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. And when intelligence is lost, one falls down into the material pool.
Beautiful translation.
As you said, you know, every problem in our life is...
Exactly. Only thing I think in the translation, they have translated buddhi as memory.
Memory.
Buddhi is more like discrimination.
Right.
And you know, Lord, if we take a small example, I see something and therefore I want it. I see a phone, I see a smartphone, I want a smartphone because otherwise my phone is a dumb phone. I want a smartphone. And why did I get the desire to have the smartphone? Because I saw it.
Because I think we've been made to believe that you're smart only if you use a smartphone.
It's more, yeah. Yes, that's what we have been made to believe. Because
really, that's what happens. You're uncool if you're not using a latest phone, right?
Correct. And so you want it. But then, you know, your parents say, no, you're not yet grown enough. You're not grown up. You don't need a phone only. Forget a smartphone. So this desire slowly starts growing into a lust, kind of like, I can't live life without that phone. Come on, everybody has it. I need it. And then when it's continuously denied, if it's satiated, what happens is you go to a higher desire then. You say, okay, the smartphone is fine, but now I want a Samsung. I want an iPhone. Maybe it goes higher. But if it is not, at some point, of course, it can't be fulfilled because you can't fulfill all the desires. That's what Gandhiji said. The world has enough for all men's needs, but not even for one man's greed. And therefore, you're not able to fulfill that. That leads to anger. And with anger, you lose your ability to think rationally. You lose discrimination. And when you lose discrimination, you act and speak and think in a manner that is inhuman. That is animalistic. That is not good. And that is when you're on the path of total ruin. That's what Krishna says. So the root cause is desire. And that's why, you know, instead of battling everything else, Swami always goes to the root cause. He says, therefore, have a ceiling on desires.
And when Swami spoke about the ceiling on desires program, Swami introduced another dimension to it, which later, you know, led to a little bit of confusion which Swami had to come and sort out.
Hmm.
But what Swami said was, see, now I want you to have ceiling on desires. So you're going to reduce your expenses. So you'll have money. So Swami said, why not use that money for more nobler causes?
Exactly.
So why don't you save that money and use it for charity? That's what Swami was saying. And you know, there is a very beautiful, subtler aspect to this, what Swami said. It was not just that since money is there, you can do it for charity. You know, a Western psychologist did this small study in his class of students. You know, one day he said, I'm not going to take class for you. You're free. And he gave them all money and he said, you can go to the nearest Starbucks and have your meal there. You know, that's what he told them. And he said, come back and make a mental note of how you enjoyed your afternoon. They didn't realize that it was part of his experiment. So he said, just go and have your fun. So after a few months, he said that today we're going to have again a free hour. And he said, all of you can go to a nearby spastic society kind of a thing, you know, where you have specially able children. He said, go and spend an afternoon with them, you know, read for them, play with them. So the class was dispatched and they had to go there and spend the afternoon. And something like 6 months later, he said, do you remember the 2 days when I let you off free? He said, which of those 2 days you remember? And then they realized that though they had as much fun in the Starbucks as they had in that orphanage or in that special school, they remembered the joy which they got from being spending that afternoon with the special children.
Wow.
So he proved to them that both are desires, desires for happiness, but the happiness which comes out of certain events seem to have the ability to last longer. So in fact, that is what Swami was trying to do here. He was saying, reduce the desires which are actually the short-lived happiness-giving desire types, and invest what you get from them, the resources, in those happinesses and desires which can actually give you long-lasting peace and joy.
Yes, and it's not only about money. Money is one aspect. You know, this time, imagine if I can say that ever since I've got a smartphone, the time I've spent on phone is definitely double or triple than the amount that I used to spend before on the phone. Which means it has consumed so much of time. The desire for the smartphone has consumed so much of my time. That much time I can save. I can use that time in something useful. I can teach a child mathematics. So it's not only about money. It's about time, it's about energy, it's about food. In fact, Narayan Seva, we heard that. Swami himself said that Narayan Seva doesn't mean buying extra food and giving it to the poor. Narayan Seva means when I am eating, I keep aside some of my food. And Swami in fact says, treat that as bhiksha or, you know, alms to Swami himself. So instead of eating 3 bread pieces, which is my normal capacity, I sacrifice 1 bread piece and eat only 2. And that bread piece, I mean, symbolically, that much I accumulate every day. Over a period of time, it accumulates into a decent amount, which I cook and offer to the needy people as food. Which means that food is born out of my sacrifice. It is not as if just because I earn extra, I use extra money and throw it at them. I have sacrificed. It has inculcated in me the spirit of sacrifice, put limits, and therefore, you know, so ceiling on desires is all about this. But as you said, there was a period in time when it was misinterpreted.
Right, you know, because it was during that 1980s time when Swami started this program. And some people thought that the 60th birthday was coming, 1985. And the organization wanted to do something large. And Swami had actually struck upon a plan of, you know, getting the coffers of the organization filled. I'm not telling that people actually felt like this, but they felt this was a good opportunity to contribute to the organization. And that is why Swami had started this program. And I think sometime a year or so later after Swami declared this as a charter in the organization, some devotees came back with a lot of money, saying that, Swami, this has come out of our ceiling on desires.
We have cut on our desires, right, and saved his money.
We have adopted this measure and this is what we've got. And it seems Swami was so wild with that. Because he said, see, you've done it, but you've done it with the wrong motive. Swami said, I've asked you to practice ceiling on desires not because I want that money, or not because the organization needs it, or not because the poor need it. Because it's a good practice for you.
You're doing this seva not to benefit others, but to benefit yourself.
Right.
Beautiful. I mean, that was one wrong interpretation that came, that maybe, you know, we can save this money and donate it to the organization. I mean, that's a noble thought, definitely, but that was not the intention with which Swami started the Ceiling on Desires program. In fact, in a talk in Abbotsbury, Madras, when Swami was speaking to, I think, some industrial workers, he made this very clear. He said, no, ceiling on desires is not for collecting money so you can give others. Ceiling on desires is to improve your own way of life. Because, you know, in another 50th birthday discourse, Swami clearly says, who is the richest man on earth? He who has much contentment is the richest man on earth. Who is the poorest man in the world? He who has much desires is the poorest man. So Swami started the Ceiling on Desires program in order to enrich us. Not in the way we thought, but in the way of curtailing our desires and increasing our contentment. Because, you know, Swami showed, he said, this was what you used to consume. Now you consume less, put a ceiling on it. You find yourself happier. How is it that you're happier though you're consuming less? You're happier because your contentment has grown. And if with what you have saved you're able to do some noble activity, that is a good byproduct, that's all. That is not the intention. You're not saving in order to do some activity. You're saving in order to have your own progress, your own growth, increase in your contentment, peace and happiness. The things that we started for in the beginning. And that is where it is going wrong, where people say that consuming is the way to get peace and happiness and contentment. No. Having a ceiling on desires is a way to get peace and contentment.
Precisely. You know, even though we speak about the organization or charitable work benefiting out of ceiling on desires. In fact, we started with the environment benefiting out of ceiling on desires. But coming to it, even that is also going to be a byproduct of this we adapting Sailing on Desires. Because, you know, essentially speaking, what Swami was teaching us was, going back to that Gulab Jamun example, we always thought that the joy was coming out of that object, or of we getting that object. It was only that Swami was trying to prove that the happiness is already inside, and events actually let you connect to that happiness within.
In fact, if you get your one Gulab Jamun, if there is a boy who has been deprived of it, you just try, go and give that Gulab Jamun to him and make him happy. You will see your heart will warm up with such warmth which you never got by just you yourself eating Gulab Jamun. Sacrifice doesn't mean you lose something, you get so much more added on to you. And that is what Sailing on Desires is all about. I think, Prem, we should play that small discourse clip where Swami emphatically refutes and says that this is not the purpose of Sailing on Desires, that is to save up money and whatever resources and donate it for a cause. It is not as if you are alleviating suffering or alleviating poverty through Sailing on Desires. Sailing on Desires is for you to grow in every sense, holistically, as a complete person with contentment and joy.
Right. This was, of course, not that discourse which you referred to in Abbotsbury.
Huh.
This was a little later, I think 84.
Okay.
But nevertheless, Swami is
speaking on the same lines.
Very powerfully making the same point.
Dhanasito Sai Iyoka Samastana ne Parambinchaledu. Sai has not launched this organization for the sake of money. Niyoka Asananu Arikattukoni Vairagya Margamanandu Divyanandamanu Anubhavinchamani Nayoka Asha. It has been my hope that you'll curb your desires, develop the sense of detachment, and thereby experience untold bliss and joy.
Sai Ati Pavitramanti Na Bhavamanu Arthamu Chesukonaka Kevalamu Sailing on Desires Lopala ధనమును మాత్రమే సమస్తకు అర్పితముగా ఉంచుకోవటం ఇది ప్రధాన లక్ష్యంగా మీరు భావిస్తూ వచ్చారు.
సో యూ హ్యావ్ లాస్ట్ సైట్ ఆఫ్ దిస్ సీక్రెట్ హోప్ ఆఫ్ మైండ్ అండ్ యూ హ్యావ్ గివెన్ యువర్ సెల్ఫ్ అవే టు ఫీలింగ్ దట్ ఇఫ్ యూ సేవ్ ఎనఫ్ మనీ ఇట్స్ మోర్ దెన్ ఎనఫ్ అండర్ ది సీలింగ్ ఆన్ డిజైర్స్.
ఇది సరైనటువంటి మార్గం కాదు.
దిస్ ఈస్ నాట్ ద కరెక్ట్ వే ఆఫ్ ఇంటర్ప్రెటింగ్ దిస్.
ఈనాడు భారతదేశంలో సీలింగ్ ఆన్ డిజైర్స్ అనేటువంటి రూపంలో డిజైర్స్ ను మాత్రము అనగా ఆశలను మాత్రం అరికట్టుకునక కేవలం డబ్బును మాత్రమే ప్రోగు చేసి సత్యసాయి ట్రస్ట్ పేరు లోపల 60 లక్షలు కట్టారు.
టుడే ఇన్ దిస్ కంట్రీ ఆఫ్ భారత్, మిస్గైడెడ్ బై దిస్ ఐడియా దట్ దిస్ ఇస్ వాట్ ద సీలింగ్ ఆన్ డిజైర్స్ మీన్స్, పీపుల్ హ్యావ్ సేవ్డ్ అప్ మనీ అండ్ ఇన్ ద నేమ్ ఆఫ్ ద సత్యసాయి సెంట్రల్ ట్రస్ట్ హ్యావ్ అక్యుములేటెడ్ 60 లక్షల రూపీస్.
నేను ధనం నాశించేటువంటి యొక్క పిచ్చుభావం నాలో లేదు.
ఐ నెవర్ హ్యావ్ దిస్ డర్టీ ఫీలింగ్ ఆఫ్ ట్రైంగ్ టు గో ఫర్ వెల్త్.
ఈనాడే కాదు, ఏనాడు కూడాను నేను ఎవరిని ఇంతవరకు కూడాను నేను ధనం కావాలని ఆశించినటువంటి క్షణం కూడాను లేదు.
నాట్ ఓన్లీ టుడే బట్ ఆల్సో ఇన్ ద పాస్ట్ నెవర్ హ్యాస్ దేర్ బీన్ ఎ మోమెంట్ ఆర్ ఎ సెకండ్ వెన్ ఐ హావ్ క్రేవ్డ్.
నా పవిత్రమైనటువంటి కర్మలే ఆ ధనములకు తగినటువంటి కార్యములు జరుపుతూ వస్తున్నాయి.
వెన్ ఐ హావ్ క్రేవ్డ్ ఎ లాంగ్ ఫర్ మనీ ఆల్ దీస్ నోబుల్ ఇంటెన్షన్స్ బిహైండ్ ఎవ్రీ యాక్షన్ ఆఫ్ మైన్ ఈచ్ ఆఫ్ దెమ్ దెమ్సెల్వ్స్ వుడ్ జనరేట్ ద మనీ నెసెసరీ.
కనుక నాకు ఇవ్వవలసినటువంటిది నాకు పవిత్రమైనటువంటి ప్రేమతత్వం తప్ప ఈ ధనము నాకు అక్కరలేదు.
సో వాట్ యు హావ్ టు గివ్ మీ టుడే ఈస్ దిస్ సేక్రెడ్ కాన్సెప్ట్ ఆఫ్ లవ్, నాట్ దిస్ ఫిల్దీ మనీ.
సో దట్ వాస్ ఎ డిస్కోర్స్ విచ్ వాస్ డెలివర్డ్ ఆన్ 1985, 21st November. యు నో, వెరీ బ్యూటిఫుల్. స్వామి ఈజ్ సేయింగ్ డోంట్ గివ్ మీ ద మనీ దట్ కమ్స్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ సీలింగ్ ఆన్ డిజైర్స్, గివ్ మీ ద సాక్రిఫైస్ విచ్ కమ్స్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ సీలింగ్ ఆన్ డిజైర్స్.
ద లవ్,
లవ్ అండ్ సాక్రిఫైస్, దట్స్ వాట్ విల్ మేక్ మీ హ్యాపీ.
ఇట్స్ రియలీ a very poignant thought for all of us to enshrine in our hearts. You know, we can go on and on about it, but basically sealing on desires, it comes from the truth that joy comes not by fulfilling your desires, not by fulfilling all your desires, because there's no end to desires, but joy comes by having contentment. And the objective behind Sailing on Desires is to make every person in the world the richest and the wealthiest, because as Swami says, the richest man in the world is he who has maximum contentment.
And as one famous quote goes, it is said that the joy that one gets by annihilating one desire is much, much more than satisfying 100 desires.
Exactly. Even another wise man had said, non-seeking is divinity. I mean, you don't seek. Maybe we can just conclude this with one more subtle point, one beautiful point, again, which was made by Professor Anil Kumar based on Swami's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
He said, all this is fine, but what about my desire for God? should that not keep increasing beyond limit? So do you mean to say that I need to have a limit there also, ceiling on desire for God?
Mm-hmm.
For that, interesting question, right? And Professor Anil Kumar, based on Swami's teachings and Swami's discourse, he gave a beautiful and succinct answer. He said, you desire for something that you don't have. You don't say that I desire for my head. Why? You already have the head. If you say like that, somebody will think you're headless. I mean, in the literal and every sense. So you desire for only something that you don't have, or something that you have lost. So when you say I desire for God, it either means you don't have God or you have lost God. Okay? And he says it cannot be possible that you don't have God, because Swami himself has said that, you know, I anoraniyan mahato mahiyan, I pervade the smallest of the small to the biggest of the big. I'm present in everything. And he also, Swami tells in the discourse, ni jantane, ni kantane, ni antane, I am above you, below you, around you, everywhere, in you. So how can God not be with you? So how can you desire for God? No. Therefore you have just lost God, and that's why you are desiring. You have lost God in the sense you have lost a connection, you have forgotten the truth, and therefore that anomaly is coming up as a desire for God. Otherwise desiring for God is something that is impossible. You can't desire for God because God is always with you. And so I think with that, it comes to a nice conclusion that we cannot conveniently say that therefore desiring for God is not good, or it is not about desiring, because God is always with us, He's always guiding us, and it really fills my heart with such a kind of solace and joy. Can feel Swami sitting here on the chair. I'm sure He's smiling at what we are speaking. I'm sure He's happy. He's content, and His blessings are on us are also the same, that we too be happy, and that we can be by being content. And the way to be content is via the Ceiling on Desires program.
Yes, dear listeners, and as we conclude and as we let the stage be taken over by Chandu, we're going to leave you with what is happening for Swami's birthday this time. Radio Sai started a new initiative which we would like all of you to participate in. We are sending out a message saying that what is your gift for Swami going to be for Swami's 88th birthday? There is a new posting on the website. If you can go to www.radiosai.org, you can contribute your thoughts. What are you wishing to do for Swami on his birthday this time? And you can send in your entries as articles, not more than 300 words. Or you can even record what you wish to say as a video or an audio clipping and send it to us. We wish to offer it to the rest of the world and say that this is what we all wish to do for Swami, inspire people to do more for Swami in the same way. So,
dear listeners, any thoughts that you have on the Ceiling on Desires and anything that you wish to share, we are as always welcome and open to it. We would love to learn. We would love to be part of your thought process too, so that, because that is what makes this a satsang, a sangh, that is a group where noble thoughts come in from all sides. Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu. With that, we offer our most humble gratitude at Bhagwan's lotus feet and bring this afternoon satsang segment to a close with this song.
Allah deta hai, banda leta hai.